Thanks for listening to The Business. If you like to get the inside word on the business, and you must if you're listening to this podcast, check out Elvis Mitchell and The Treatment. Each week, Elvis hosts intimate conversations with pop culture luminaries about their influences, their lives, and their work. And each week, you'll be amazed at the insights you hear. Check it out. Find The Treatment on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
The iPad requires a distillation of what you mean to say, which is sometimes a great advantage on a film set.
No one argues with an iPad.
Filmmakers Richard Glatzer and Wash Westmoreland are a married couple who directed Still Alice, a film that's put Julianne Moore in the Oscar race for her performance as a woman struggling with Alzheimer's. Glatzer was on the set despite his own diagnosis of ALS, which has left him unable to speak without the help of an iPad. But first, we banter as we head to Sundance. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So as we record, we are just heading into the Sundance Film Festival. We've already seen a deal before the festival even starts, which happens. Noah Baumbach has sold a movie called Mistress America, which stars his close friend, Greta Gerwig. It's a film about a sad and lonely college student who is having some adventures with her soon-to-be stepsister. Mistress America sold for almost $7 million to Fox Searchlight. Not a new player in the Sundance game by any means. And so it begins, but there are new players in the Sundance game, which suggests that there's going to be a lot of sharks swimming around in that pond looking for something delicious to eat, if sharks are found in ponds, actually.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing in the Sundance market these last few years has been the emergence of all these new players, like Netflix, Amazon buying movies. Now you have Overstock.com, CNN is buying documentaries, Showtime. I mean, there are so many different people looking for content now for these different outlets, that it's not, for most films at Sundance, if you're in the major categories, it's not a matter of will you find a deal, it's what deal can you find and what outlet is best for that film.
Yeah, I mean, Sundance, as John Cooper, who is running it now, has said, you know, there was a time, just not that long ago, where it got very starry and the deals were really big, multi-million dollar deals going like crazy, all-night auctions. They've moved somewhat away from that. They're trying to do, you know, they're trying to be more serious about the kind of films they program and less commercial. And I think that's happened. But at the same time, as you say, because of this new influx of all kinds of buyers, we really are in an era right now that is so content crazy. I'm talking about, you know, in all media, you know, we've just had an incredible number of people presenting at the Television Critics Association, an incredible amount of channels trying to come up with original content. And as you said, both Amazon and now Overstock getting into the game. And I just want to pause a second there, because what's really interesting to me is this idea that Amazon, which is a streaming service, wants to bring out its movies. Unlike Netflix, which has already said they're going to do this, they're going to put these movies in theaters. They say 4 to 8 weeks before they are streamable. And that is going to lead to an interesting conversation with theater owners.
Right. And, you know, they're going incrementally because they're not trying to put large studio movies in theaters, something like The Interview, which caused so much trouble for Sony. They're saying these are small, festival-oriented, indie-style movies that they're going to put in theaters, and then they're going to run on Amazon. And what better place to find small, festival-style indie movies than at the best place for that those kinds of movies, Sundance.
Which might lead theater owners to be a little bit more receptive to the idea of only like a 4-week window after it's been in theaters. You know, that would be very short for a studio movie. There would be a big revolt among theater owners. But if it's a smaller movie, yeah, maybe they can get away with it. I also find the idea of maybe as many as 12 movies a year from Amazon, and then Overstock, you know, not far behind with its own idea of doing movies. I don't know that they're doing them in theaters, but they're planning to stream movies. It is getting pretty crazy out there.
And you know what? You know what the best thing is that the best movies, the most popular movies, are the ones that are going to find the audience. And now it doesn't matter where it comes from, because if you are Netflix and you want to, you know, shell out money for a great movie at Sundance, you can do it, and you can outbid some of the traditional players.
I should note also about Sundance going in that two of the movies in Oscar contention this year, Whiplash and Boyhood, were available at Sundance last year. So that only adds to the sense that if you hunt and you really have, you know, you're on your game, you're going to find that movie. And so therefore, well, we'll talk a little bit about some of the movies they have to choose from. Let's start with documentaries. There's a couple of high-profile documentaries that are certainly going to get a lot of attention. Of course, one of them is already spoken for, one that I should mention that I do appear in briefly and have written about in our magazine, The Hollywood Reporter, in this current issue.
Yeah, Going Clear, which is the Scientology documentary, that's set to premiere on the 25th of January. That's from Alex Gibney, who has been a guest on the show. He did the Armstrong Lie and an Enron documentary, Elliot Spitzer documentary, a lot of great documentaries. That one is also going to premiere on HBO after it leaves Sundance. Another film that I think is going to get a lot of attention is this, The Hunting Ground, which already has a buyer in the Weinstein's radius, and it's going to air on CNN. But that's about college rape and some of the cover-ups involved, and it's from the director Kirby Dick, who did The Invisible War, which was a big documentary about sexual assault on military campuses. So there's a lot of very hot-button documentaries this year, and I think that Sundance knows that if they can get people talking about these things, it's going to just draw more attention to the festival.
Yeah, I mean, CNN bought Blackfish at Sundance a couple of years ago, and that turned out to be a big thing, and these things can command quite a lot of attention and have quite a big impact, I should say.
And CNN is a buyer that people, until a couple of years ago, never would have associated with Sundance.
Yeah, it has been something that's really worked for them. You know, they've gotten some decent ratings out of these things, which God knows they need. So getting back to the scripted films, you know, these things don't always work. You know, last year there was a big bidding war for Zach Braff's movie, Which I Was Here, which he funded through Kickstarter, and it just kind of vanished without a trace. And that is the downside, you know, to the Sundance feeding frenzy. It can really turn around and bite you. But there are some movies, a surprising number of what are called comedies. I don't know if the Sundance definition of comedy is exactly the kind of, you know, knee-slapping thing. But there's one called The Bronze. It's opening night film. Melissa Rauch from The Big Bang Theory stars as a washed-up Olympic gymnast who lives in her father's basement. Sounds like it could be a pretty funny premise. And that, as I said, opening night, which is a big vote of confidence for a movie, you know, that is a comedy.
Yeah, I mean, Sundance typically likes to put a crowd pleaser on that opening night. And if it's a comedy and it gets a lot of attention for it being actually funny, I could see that film, you know, finding a buyer fairly quickly.
Yeah, and there's also a film called The D Train with Jack Black and Mike White teaming up. It's a comedy about, and I think it's a comedy, but it's not. It's a kind of a dramedy. Jack Black, I think, is an insecure man facing his 20th high school reunion. They're saying it's a pretty dramatic performance from Jack Black, so that one might attract a fair bit of attention.
The one that I find interesting is this Mississippi Grind, which is it's from the filmmakers who did Half Nelson, which got Ryan Gosling an Oscar nomination. And this one is with Ryan Reynolds, and it's set in the world of poker in the South. If that one hits on all cylinders, I think it could be a big one for buyers.
And there's A Walk in the Woods, which actually stars not technically Sundance founder, but essentially the modern founder of Sundance, Robert Redford, as a aging travel writer who hikes the Appalachian Trail with his long estranged high school friend, Nick Nolte. So that could be, you know, it's an underserved audience, older people, and that could potentially find a buyer too.
And Redford often doesn't make very many appearances at Sundance anymore, and it'll be nice to see him out promoting one of his own films.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Critics have lamented a shortage of great roles for women in the past year, but one standout performance was Julianne Moore in Still Alice, about a linguistics professor struggling with early-onset Alzheimer's. At one point, Alice tries to explain to her daughter, played by Kristen Stewart, what she's going through.
I've always been so defined by my intellect, my language, my articulation, and now sometimes I can see the words hanging in front of me and I can't reach them and I don't know who I am and I don't know what I'm going to lose next.
This small film premiered in September at the Toronto Film Festival, where Moore's performance immediately sparked talk of awards. Moore has already won a Golden Globe for her performance. Alzheimer's Attacks the Mind, the directors of Still Alice, Wash Westmoreland and Richard Glatzer, are a married couple dealing with a disease that attacks the body. 4 years ago, Glatzer was diagnosed with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. He's continued to write and direct even as he's lost the ability to walk and speak. Glatzer communicates now by using his toe to tap on his iPad. When we sat down with him in Westmoreland in their Echo Park home, Glatzer typed some responses and selected others that he'd prepared beforehand. Normally, we don't provide questions in advance, but in this case, for obvious reasons, we made an exception. Glatzer and Westmoreland co-wrote the script for Still Alice, and this is not their first collaboration. They co-wrote and co-directed other films, including the 2006 movie Quinceañera. Westmoreland says he and Glatzer are still very much a team, even though their working process has had to change.
When we're writing something, we hash out a lot of our creative differences there. The hope being when we get onto the set, we have a creative unity that then spreads out to the cast and the crew. As Richard's lost the ability to speak, he's been using an iPad with a text-to-speech device in order to communicate, and we've tried to keep as much as possible the same dynamic going, that we have our quiet time together to get on the same page. And when we got onto the set, obviously, I do more of the communicating and talking, but Richard still has full creative input over every decision.
So would you go, I don't know whether to direct this question to which one of you, but would you go in a wheelchair and watch the goings-on?
At the time of shooting, Richard was still able to walk. I mean, he was first told 4 years ago that he had ALS, and it was bulbar ALS, so it started in his tongue in the form of a lisp, and by about a year, it was getting very difficult to understand Richard, so that's when we started phasing in the iPad. But his motor skills in his arms and legs were good up until the beginning of last year. Just as we were approaching production, the things he normally used to do with his arms and hands started to become more and more difficult. And we had to deal with that as we were making the film.
I read that for Richard, you know, the stress of making this film was quite taxing and that you lost a considerable bit of weight. And I'm trying to think of, to pose this in the yes or no way. I mean, worth it to you?
Definitely. People say, aren't you brave and inspiring for doing this? But honestly, getting to make a film with Juliet Moore and this team of actors and department heads was a dream realized.
The actual, you know, making a film, anyone will tell you, it will, you know, take 5 years off your life. And in Richard's state and in the winter in New York last year was brutal.
Awful,
and it
yeah.
was just difficult for Richard at the time, was still eating orally. Right now he has a feeding tube, but he was still eating orally. And it was just very hard for him to get enough calories every day. And he was losing a lot of weight. We didn't quite realize, because you're so obsessed with the film, what was going on. But when he was weighed in his clinic's appointment at the end of the film, he dropped 12 pounds. And, you know, it was at the point he had to go in for a feeding tube operation so he could get more calories every day in order to keep his weight up.
Now I'm fat.
I'm just here. This is radio. You don't look fat. So that's a lot of dedication. I mean, that is a profound love for this project and for film, I have to say. Did you find there were things that you could say as a director with an iPad that you couldn't do before?
No one argues with an iPad.
That is true. It's hard to argue with an iPad.
I will say, yeah, the iPad requires, you know, a distillation of what you mean to say, which is sometimes a great advantage on a film set.
It's hard to yell at people with an iPad, too.
Well, just stick it through a PA system, crank it up. But it really means cut to the chase. You know, when it takes a while to type a sentence has to be really important.
And you did feel, I think you said, you felt very much heard.
Totally.
So, Richard, was there ever a part of you that just felt like, you know what, I'm ill and I just don't want to be dealing with this?
No, never.
When Richard was first told that he probably had ALS, we had to really think about what we wanted to do with our lives. And we actually went for a weekend at Zion National Park and, you know, climbed up a mountain. And I said, well, what do you want to do? Should we just kind of pack everything in and sell the house and travel around the world and just go, you know, screw it? And he's like, I want to make movies. And I was like, well, so do I, but we've been trying to make movies for the last 5 years without a lot of success. He goes, I don't care. I want to make movies. That's what I want to do. And since then, we've had the good fortune to make 2 feature films, Last of Robin Hood and Still Alice.
I'm wondering, I'm going to ask this as a yes or no question for you, Richard. When you're listening to Wash speak for you at this point in these interviews, is it very frustrating at times because he's not saying quite what you want him to say the way you want him to say it?
He's great.
Oh, that's nice. It's very, very good. I'm glad to see that you're getting that support there, Wash.
Yeah, me too.
As you soldier through trying to speak for the two of you.
It is difficult. We wondered how to handle it with, you know, professional contacts with actors that we'd meet, you know, when we were actually talking to people about signing on to do the film. And we thought it's difficult to start a meeting with a big medical explanation about what's going on in your lives. You want to really just get into talking about the project. And we had a friend who said, just make light of it. Just say you're the Penn and Teller of indie screen directing. And that became our tagline.
You guys, we mentioned before, you had been in this sort of drought of filmmaking. You did Quinceanera in 2006. Now, normally one would think that this film, which won the Grand Jury Prize and the Audience Award at Sundance that year, you know, you've broken through and all is fantastic, but that's not what happened.
Exactly. When we won the prizes at Sundance, I remember saying to Richard, you know, it's all going to be like Hollywood parties and studio contracts, and I really don't want our lives to change. And then 2 years later, we were sitting at the table in Echo Park trying to work out how to not get the electricity cut off. And I was like, well, our lives could have changed a little bit. We just didn't get the breaks after Quinceañera. And, you know, that's the thing about indie filmmaking, there's never any security. If you actually posted the job description, I think people would think you were crazy that you worked for years and years on a project. It might not ever happen. If it happens, it might not get into the right festival. If it gets into the festival, it might not get picked up for distribution. And if it gets picked up for distribution, the critics might kill it.
Right. But
what
aside
a great
from
job.
This is a role in the park, right?
Yeah. And also if you work on we're working on several projects, but if you work on a film for 4 or 5 years and then you realize it's not actually ever going to move into production, no one's going to give you a silver medal and say, congratulations, you came in second. That would have been a really great film. That time is just kind of gone, which is, you know, something you have to deal with as you move forward.
So this film, you were given the novel, I believe, by some producer friends of yours and immediately sparked to the book. And I don't know if that was informed already by Richard's illness or whether you were not yet quite aware of that.
Just at the time my illness, ALS, was taking hold, James Brown and Lex Lutz's, two British producers we knew, sent us the book Still Alice. Pure coincidence, they knew nothing about my disease. And though ALS and Alzheimer's are very different diseases, it was a very hard read for me, it hit way too close. But when I finished reading, I knew we had to do it.
You had approached Julianne Moore for your previous film, The Last of Robin Hood. She didn't sign on to that one.
I know. It's interesting. Sometimes out of a closed door, another one will open. In this case, in the process of getting to know Julianne and talking to her about Last of Robin Hood, we found we really liked each other and really wanted to work together. And then Susan Sarandon signed on to do Last of Robin Hood, and we were very happy, and wrote to Julianne and said, well, you know, we've got another one now. And over Last of Robin Hood, she spent 2 months wondering about whether to do it or not. This time, within 2 days, she was straight on Skype saying, yeah, I'm in, I want to do it. And it was a great day for us.
Coming up after a short break, directors Westmoreland and Glatzer on their unlikely career paths that started with Westmoreland directing pornographic films and Glatzer working on divorce court. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. This year's Golden Globes had some surprise wins, but handicappers had long seen Julianne Moore as a strong bet to take home an award for her performance in the film Still Alice.
I want to thank the people who actually made the movie, James Brown and Lex Luthor and Sony Classics and my good friends at Killer Films and this amazing cast. And mostly our filmmakers who, in the middle of their own crisis with a degenerative disease, ALS, decided that they wanted to make movies because they wanted to celebrate who we are and what we value and who we love. And my mother, you know, Rich, I'm sorry, I didn't say their names, Wash Westmoreland and Rich Glatzer.
Today we're talking with Westmoreland and Glatzer, who, aside from dealing with a grave health crisis, faced the same hurdles that confront most indie filmmakers. In the case of Still Alice, finding funding for the film wasn't a lock, even after Moore lent her star power to the project.
We decided we were going to cast the top three slots before we really went out to financiers. And Julianne Moore came on and Kristen Stewart then came on. So we thought that was a really good hand. And our producer says, no, let's wait until we have the third lead.
The guy.
And so we were looking at a short list of actors, and we wanted whoever we cast to be compatible with Julianne because they are playing a married couple and we wanted them to have a natural chemistry. And Julianne had worked with Alec in 30 Rock. And they had a great time together and were looking for something to work on together again. And so she actually texted him. And by the end of the weekend, he said, yeah, I want to do this. I'm signing on. And we were very happy because I think it's not a conventional Alec Baldwin role. I think it shows a side of him you haven't seen before.
Where did the financing come from?
Financing came out of a French company called BSM. And they saw the script, saw the package, responded to it, and were the sole financier.
Wash, I wanted to ask you, I read about you, you were in Fresh Air in 2002. You are the first guest we've ever had in my tenure as host that has a background in adult film. I'm kind of excited about that because I'm really curious about whether your experience, you were working under different names, mm-hmm. I guess. Wash West, and is Bud Light also one of those names? Mm-hmm. Did that experience inform your experience doing non-adult films, and how?
Well, when I first came to LA...
You have quite a filmography.
I have quite an IMDb page. And when I first came to LA in the 90s, no one else was paying me to make films. And that's how I thought of them. I approached them as films. I was very much into the stories and the characters and the subtext and, you know, the lighting and everything. It was my way of learning how to make films in that period. And also during that time, we had a screenplay we were writing called The Fluffer that took place within the adult industry. And we just thought it was a fascinating subculture in which to set a
feature. Now, were you two together at that point?
We were together at that point, and it led to making The Fluffer in 2000. It was our first feature.
So that was like a bridge from the gay adult film world to a not adult film.
Yeah.
That was very gracefully put.
It was. Yeah. The Fluffer was the transition into, you know, independent
so
film.
Were you always thinking, I'm going to make this move into mainstream?
Oh, yeah. I always went into it as a filmmaker, you know. And I feel that, I'm proud of my work. I feel like it's, you know, I made films. Yeah, I was working solo. Richard was working in reality TV at the time.
Oh, right. I read that you were doing like America's Next Top Model. Did I remembering that right? And Divorce Court.
Yeah.
It's coming back. See the memory occasionally.
Grief.
Richard's first film that came out in the early 90s, Grief, that was kind of part of a new queer cinema, came from his experiences of working on Divorce Court that was a daytime...
Right, I know
trash
that.
TV show,
yeah,
let's call it.
That
was actually Andy Warhol's favorite TV show, he said in his diary.
I think I
very
remember
proud
it, or maybe I just remember the name. Yeah.
And that led to the experience of making Grief. Every film that we've made, I think, you know, one of the great things about going to do different films is each one takes you into a different world. like Quinceañera was, you know, getting to know our neighborhood better and the Latino community in LA better. Last of Robin Hood led us to know lots of Errol Flynn fanatics and lots of people who were around in the 50s. And Still Alice has led us to know lots of people in the Alzheimer's community. Oh, yeah, okay. Ridge just wanted me to say that Grief played Sundance, it played Toronto Film Festival. It was like his first kind of...
A calling card movie.
Yeah, calling card as a movie, yeah.
And so at what point did you two meet?
We met in 1995 at a party in Silver Lake, and we just immediately started talking about movies, and I think talked about movies all night long and just hit it off.
Had you done Grief at that point or no? Yes. You had done. So you had made your first foray into actually getting into film, and you were still on the cusp, kind of.
Yeah.
And Fluffer was the joint project that you did together.
In 2000.
I mean, it's remarkable now you find yourself, I mean, on the cusp of, you know, you're in the awards race. How is that for you guys?
Well, when we made Still Alice, we weren't really thinking about awards. We were just thinking about the film. And when we were in post and we saw the way the performance was coming together, we thought this could be something really special here. But you never really know until you've tested it with an audience. And we had a test screening just after we'd been editing about 6 weeks. And everyone ticked the box of for Julianne's performance. Everybody gave it 5 out of an audience of like 30 people. And we thought, wow, we're not deluding ourselves. There's really something here.
And so how did you inject it into the Oscar conversation? You had your theatrical release. The real theatrical release is in January, is this month. You had a qualifying run, I guess, probably in a very limited number of theaters. But so how did you... did you hire a consultant? How did you say we're going to get this out there and make it part of the conversation?
It really came from Toronto Film Festival.
Right, because immediately people started to say that Julianne's performance was potentially an Oscar.
We were running to get the film finished for Toronto, and there wasn't a lot of buzz going into the festival. I think we were mentioned in maybe one article. And when we had our premiere, it was like a Monday afternoon slot, and it was really exciting because the audience just really responded to the film. And we got some very positive reviews from that night. And then the next day, a piece appeared in the trades saying, if a distributor picks this up and runs with this year, this could be an alignment of the planets for Julianne Moore. And Sony Picture Classics stepped forward, and we'd been with them for Quinceañera. We know Michael Barker and Tom Bernard. We love those guys. And they said, we want to do it, and we want to do it right. They'd worked with Julianne at the beginning of her career. They did movies like Myth of Fingerprints and Vanya on 42nd Street with her. And they said they wanted to come back now and work with her on this campaign.
And so that was it. There was no picking and choosing. It was Sony Pictures from the start.
We had a couple of other offers, but Sony was by far and away the way we wanted to go. And the crucial part of that decision was they didn't want to hold it. They wanted to release it in 2014. They saw that like the lightning was striking now, and they had to run with it. A lot of people picking up a movie at Toronto would wait until the next year and prepare a campaign. With, you know, more lead time, but they just saw the necessity to push it out right now.
I just want to ask one more thing quickly. Richard, I don't know whether you were a patient man before, but this has to teach you patience, whether you wanted to learn it or not. Were you previously much more impatient?
Very.
Impatient.
So this has been a challenge to learn the patience to communicate this way, I should think.
Yes, indeed.
Now, are you guys, do you feel that you're going to be able to make more films?
Oh, yeah, we're planning to make more films. Yeah, we'll keep going as long as we can.
Wash Westmoreland and Richard Glatzer are the directors of Still Alice. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kim. It's been a pleasure.
Great talking.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Grant Buckerfield. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.